From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! A look at the House's vote to challenge the 60-year-old policy of providing public housing for the poor. New Mexico Green Party candidate Carol Miller reflects on this week's special congressional race for Bill Richardson's seat that led to the victory of the right-wing Republican. And longtime civil rights activists Staunton and Alice Lynn fight against the death sentence of a member of the White Aryan Brotherhood. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton will apologize for the Tuskegee experiment today. In a White House ceremony, Clinton will apologize to those black men whose syphilis was left untreated beginning in the 1930s in a federal experiment in Tuskegee, Alabama. Close to 400 men signed up for what was supposed to be free medical care, but they were never told they had syphilis, and they were denied treatment even after penicillin came into use. Officials say Clinton hopes to regain the faith of blacks who mistrust government to this day because of the experiment. Time Warner found its feet back in the fire over gangsta rap music, this time at its annual meeting, where an activist slammed the sexually graphic songs of the rapper Lil' Kim. C. Dolores Tucker, chair of the National Political Congress of Black Women, yesterday denounced the music as gangsta porno rap that promotes violence, especially in black communities. C. Dolores Tucker also lost part of a battle earlier this week when the women's statue that was moved to the Congressional Rotunda, Tucker had opposed the move because Sojourner Truth was not included in the suffrage lineup of Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Lucretia Mott. The U.S. Senate last night defeated a measure drafted by Democratic leader Tom Daschle that aimed to restrict late-term abortions without specifically banning the controversial procedures being done earlier in pregnancies. President Clinton has vowed to veto the Santorum bill because it does not make exceptions for the health of a pregnant woman. It was Republican from Pennsylvania Rick Santorum who introduced the bill that would prohibit the procedure, known by his anti-choice activists as the partial birth abortion. This news on the McVeigh trial. An FBI agent testified yesterday that Timothy McVeigh's fingerprints were not found on a rental agreement for the Ryder truck, on the truck's key, or at the agency where it was rented, nor were McVeigh's prints found in the truck of co-defendant Terry Nichols. Prosecutors allege Nichols drove the truck to get McVeigh from Oklahoma City after McVeigh stashed a getaway car. Meanwhile, prosecutors finally got into evidence the clothing McVeigh was wearing when he was arrested. An FBI technician held up a blue windbreaker, faded black jeans, black boots, and a T-shirt bearing the legend, "The Tree of Liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants," a quote from Thomas Jefferson. A self-styled smokers' rights group has threatened to kill journalists because of what it says is a media conspiracy to turn the United States into a tobacco-free society. The Smokers' Rights Action Group, in a fact sent to the Reuters Bureau in Dallas, Texas, charged that journalists were deliberately lying about the economic cost of smoking to society. And BRIC Group said yesterday that it and its Liggett Group tobacco subsidiary had reached a settlement in a federal class action suit in West Virginia that essentially stops all class action and individual tobacco lawsuits against Liggett nationwide. In return, Liggett, the smallest of the cigarette makers, agreed to cooperate in prosecuting conspiracy claims against other tobacco companies. In international news, Israeli planes attacked southern Lebanon twice today, a day after Hezbollah fighters killed three Israeli soldiers. Today's attacks raised the number of Israeli air raids on Lebanon since the beginning of 1997 to 32. The latest American Middle East peace initiative ended in failure today, with Yasser Arafat snubbing the U.S. envoy Dennis Ross and Palestinians staying away from a meeting with Israel on security issues. Senior Palestinian officials said Ross has not been pushing Israel hard enough to comply with the peace accords. The Palestinians have demanded that Israel stop construction of a Jewish neighborhood in a part of Jerusalem they want as a future capital. The Palestinians also want Israel to freeze the expansion of Jewish settlements. And the Israeli ambassador in Washington accused the United States of tapping the phones of Israeli officials and demanded in a letter published today that his government take harsh action. This news from South Korea. Student violence erupted in the South Korean city of Gwangju today as residents prepare to mourn victims of a 1980 army massacre in the first officially sponsored anniversary ceremony. Funeral ceremonies were timed to coincide with Sunday's anniversary of the massacre of pro-democracy students, a tragedy that has left deep scars on South Korea. At that time in 1980, estimates range between 200 and 2,000 of students killed in a revolt against martial law declared by then General Chun. Remains of those killed have been moved to a newly built cemetery in Gwangju, where they'll be honored as heroes on Sunday in a nationally televised ceremony presided over by Prime Minister Ko Khun. This news from Haiti. Hundreds of rioters rampaged through downtown Port-au-Prince yesterday, setting ablaze buildings, homes, and cars after police wounded several students who demonstrated over a school closure. There is widespread discontent in this Caribbean nation, already the poorest in the Western Hemisphere. Grassroots organizations have protested a government privatization program and austerity measures promoted by the International Monetary Fund and other foreign donors. And finally, Zaire's Mobutu Sese Seko left the capital of Kinshasa today, where he's expected to make an announcement on the Zaire crisis. His departure followed talks with army chiefs who told him they could not defend the capital against Laurent Kabila's advancing rebel forces and that he should leave for his own safety. Meanwhile, Switzerland ordered a freeze today on the villa of Mobutu Sese Seko, but not other assets of the embattled ruler, estimated to total $4 billion. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Challenging the 60-year-old federal policy of providing public housing for the poor, the House of Representatives voted this week to repeal a landmark 1937 Depression-era housing law. The measure could cut roughly in half the percentage of extremely poor tenants living in public housing. It would also force unemployed public housing tenants to work 8 hours a month, or in most cases, to risk eviction. Joining us to talk about the recent moves in Congress is Lisa Rangeli, a policy specialist at the Center for Community Change based in Washington, D.C., the group that provides training and assistance to tenants groups and other community-based organizations. We're also joined by my co-host today, Juan Gonzalez, who is a columnist with the New York Daily News.
Good day, Amy. I'd like to begin with Lisa Rangeli and ask her what specifically in the bill that the House passed and which still faces the Senate review and vote would affect the millions living in public housing in this country?
Well, of greatest concern is the fact that the bill would allow public housing authorities to provide public housing to more moderate-income families as opposed to the families with the greatest need who are very low-income, those receiving minimum wage salaries, and those making the transition from welfare to work. So for the first time, the federal government, Congress, is saying, well, we really don't think the people with the greatest need should have access to this very precious and limited resource, housing resource.
What happens to people who leave this last bastion, really, of housing, which is public housing in this country?
Well, I think we face very dire consequences. This is especially true coming on the heels of welfare, so-called welfare reform. We've just told poor people that you no longer have a safety net underneath you in case you have trouble finding a job or your income is not enough to support your family. And now we're telling them you may not even get access to a roof over your head. So it's really hitting people at both ends.
There are those who argue, for instance, I myself was a product of public housing. My parents, when they both started working to the point where their income level reached too high, we were basically moved out of public housing, told we had to leave. There are those who argue that policies over the last few years have, in essence, created total ghettos and not a good mix of working families, moderate income as well as low income. How do you answer that that argument?
Well, I would argue that we need to provide people job training, child care, all the supportive services that they need, and we need to help link them to the jobs that are out there and not, you know, replace them with higher income people. Help build people's self-sufficiency from within communities and create an income mix that way.
Jesse Jackson Jr., the Chicago Congress member, talked about the aspect of the bill that was the reason a majority of Democrats opposed it, which was the community service requirement, the 8 hours a month that public housing tenants would have to work. He called it a form of slavery. Can you talk about what was the origin of putting this into this bill and what your view is on it?
Well, it goes back to this this philosophy that we also saw in the repeal of the welfare law, that it's the fault of poor people that they're poor, and that we need to create an incentive to work. We need to force people to be have a work ethic. And so the idea is that, therefore, if you are receiving a subsidy from the federal government in terms of housing support, that you should give back something to your community. And I think there have been a lot of very reasonable arguments to point out that lots of very wealthy people receive subsidies from the federal government. Lots of corporations receive subsidies from the federal government, and they're not expected to give something back in return.
Now, how specifically would these changes work? Would they set aside a specific number of units in every public housing project for folks of different income? Does the bill speak to that at all?
The bill would set up a mix, but right now the bulk of public housing is targeted to people who are very low income, those earning less than 50% of the median income for an area, which is in the range of nationally about $22,000. So now the bulk, the majority of public housing, could go to folks earning as much as 80% of the median for an area, which nationally is in the range of the mid-$30,000 range.
So, Lisa Rangeli, what is your group doing about this right now? I mean, were you involved with lobbying against this, which is called H.R. 2 and was introduced by New York Congressmember, actually from Long Island, Rick Lazio?
Well, we've been very active in helping bring the voice of public housing resident groups to Washington. And so there have been series of actions both in Washington, D.C. and around the country. And there will be actions coming up the week of Memorial Day. Congress will be in recess that week. And groups around the country will be trying to meet with their members of Congress and voice their dissatisfaction and assert their own proactive agenda for public housing.
What has been the stand of the Clinton administration in terms of this bill?
Well, the Clinton administration opposes some of the specific provisions in this bill, particularly these income eligibility provisions that would allow more moderate income people to get access to public housing. And the bills, as you said, there will be the Senate consideration of a similar bill, which is more moderate, but would also allow deregulation and block granting of public housing.
And what does the Clinton administration think about the work requirement?
Well, the Clinton administration thinks that there should be some sort of work, not necessarily requirement, but an opportunity to encourage work and to encourage volunteer efforts, but that it would not necessarily result in the eviction of a tenant who failed to comply with that requirement.
Of course, then, the government is not expanding public housing at all, right? I mean, in most places, public housing developments are being bulldozed or the famous explosions that we've gotten accustomed to seeing on television, the imploding, I'm sorry. But is the government building any new housing?
Well, that's correct. In fact, the supply of affordable housing is shrinking just at a time when the need has been mushrooming. And the administration has committed to demolish 100,000 public housing units by the year 2000. And when you look at what really is going on with this demolition, oftentimes only a small portion of that housing is being replaced that's actually reserved for very low-income people. And what's happening in many places is private developers are coming in, they're building upscale housing, and they're getting lots of public subsidies to do that, and they're going to reap millions of dollars in profit while there'll be fewer people who now have access to affordable housing.
Lisa Rangeli, would you say that this challenge to the 60-year-old federal policy of providing public housing for the poor is the equivalent of what happened last year with the repeal of welfare, and also that President Clinton's approach to it is pretty much the same? He's voiced reservation, but it does look like a compromise is possible, that eventually he'll sign off on this.
I think, unfortunately, it is all too similar, the approach that the administration is taking and the approach that Congress is taking. And I think that, as I said before, you're hitting people at both ends, and it's going to create real problems in low-income communities and increased homelessness.
Can you give your phone number for people who want to get in touch with the community change group that you're a part of to find out what's happening on Memorial Day?
Sure. The phone number is 202-342-0519. And if it's okay, there's a second phone number also. Jennifer Anderson, who's based in New York City, she is really coordinating all of the actions around the country. So if people want to plug in, find out what's happening in their area, she would know. And her number is 718-636-3486, extension 6445.
And that number again is 718-636-3486, extension 6445. Lisa Rangeli, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Lisa is a policy specialist at the Center for Community Change, which is based in Washington, D.C. And you're listening to Democracy Now!, which broadcasts around the country from Honolulu to Maine, from Tampa to Albuquerque, New Mexico. The station there that Democracy Now! Is on is KUNM. And right now we're going to go to New Mexico to talk about this week's third congressional district race. Albuquerque and other New Mexico residents went to the polls to elect a replacement for Congressmember Bill Richardson, who gave up his seat to become ambassador to the United Nations. The race pit the favorite, Democratic candidate Eric Serna, Hispanic state official and New Mexico native, against conservative Republican Bill Redman. But the race also saw the emergence of a powerful third-party candidate, Carol Miller of the Green Party, a development that had many pundits in Washington glancing down to New Mexico with more than passing interest. And that interest was rewarded. In a stunning upset, the Republican Bill Redman defeated Serna by just 2 percentage points. That was 42-40%. And Carol Miller of the Green Party grabbed 17%. Right now, we are joined by Carol Miller from her home in New Mexico. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
I should say Carol has run a community health clinic in New Mexico and was a member of the 1993 Presidential Health Care Reform Task Force led by Hillary Clinton. Well, what are your thoughts on this day as all the votes come in and we see that, in fact, the conservative Republican won?
Well, you know, this is just a special election to fill a seat, and we don't think that Bill Redman will be able to hold on to that seat. But what really happened in this race was that there was too much money spent and too much negative campaigning, and basically the majority of people stayed home. Voter turnout was very low. It was about 33%. And what I've noticed since the election is that people are coming up to me and calling and saying, thank you for running and giving us something to vote for. And I think what we tapped into was this feeling that people have that they're tired of always going to the polls and trying to decide basically a lesser of two evils when they don't like either candidate. And so we've been pretty excited. My overall was 17%, but a lot of that was the early vote and the absentee. From among the people who went to the polls on Election Day, 1 out of 5 voted Green this time, and we think that's highly significant. We won on the day of voting. We won Santa Fe County. We ended up coming in second because of the absentee, but we also came in second in Taos County, and we think that's highly significant. I've always been a supporter of third parties, and I think that we need to have an organized force so that we can stop this deal making. I mean, today I just listened to the bipartisan budget agreement, and sometimes it's hard to figure out if there really still are two parties. There are a few progressive Democrats that continue to want to fund programs to help people, but we have the Democratic leadership in the White House making, I think, unconscionable deals with the Republicans right now.
Is this one of the highest voter turnouts that the Greens have received in a congressional race in the country?
Yes, it is. It's significantly more than was ever received by any Green running for a national office.
And in terms of, obviously, of those who argue that you've enabled the much more conservative Republican to get into office with your vote getting, how do you answer that?
Well, we really feel that it was not that critical at this point because of the makeup of the Congress, that this was a good time to show that people are ready and becoming more interested in third parties. because the makeup of the 105th Congress before the election was 206 Democrats and 227 Republicans. And this was a situation where, unlike a governor's race where there's only one in a state, that we pretty much felt that the 105th Congress was a done deal as far as how it was going to vote, and that it was an excellent opportunity to do organizing for a third voice in this state. And that's what's really exciting about it, that we received votes in every county in this district, places where no one has ever voted for, certainly for the Green Party before.
Carol, we're going to break in, and then we're going to come back to the conversation with you. Carol Miller, Green Party candidate to replace Bill Richardson. She lost, and the conservative Republican Bill Redman has won and defeated Eric Cerna by just 2 percentage points. Eric Cerna, the Democratic Party candidate. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back with Carol in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, and we're going to take this next few minutes to finish up our conversation with Green Party candidate from New Mexico, Carol Miller. And then we're going to be joined by the Lynns, Staunton and Alice Lynn, longtime scholar activists well known for their book Rank and File. They attended the Labor Notes conference just a few weeks ago, but they have taken up an interesting issue, and that's defending a man on death row who's a member of the White Aryan Brotherhood. But before we do that, Carol Miller, Juan was just asking you about the issue of being the spoiler. And you're saying basically that it doesn't really matter if there's a Republican in right now from New Mexico because of the nature of the 105th Congress. But what about particular votes around issues in New Mexico?
Well, I'm not sure how many of those there will be. I think that Bill Redman surprised people, certainly where at a forum I was at with the land grants, where he said that his first bill that he would introduce would be some kind of compensation or a land grant commission, a stronger bill, in fact, than the one that Bill Richardson had introduced. We're going to be here to watch if he comes through on any of his district-specific commitments that were made. And I think that that's what's really helpful, is to have people organized to watch the votes and to be able to do education about that. I mean, I think he will go along with the agenda, but he's also going to have someone like me watching every vote. He committed not to vote party line, but to vote for the good of the district, and we're going to be monitoring that and tracking that and doing press information about that because we think it's important to hold people to what they say when they're running.
Carol, is there any sense in terms of the vote what the inroads were that the Green Party made among Native Americans or among Latino voters in your state?
Yes, for sure, because if you look at the places where I got the bulk of my vote, there was a large Hispanic turnout for me, and some of that is because I've worked for more than 20 years in community organizations. I mean, I am a grassroots person. That's where I work, in community clinics, community economic development organizations. Received 10% of the vote in Zuni Nation. It's a little harder to break out the Navajo vote until we get the final precinct count. But one of the most exciting things that happened as a result of my campaign is that some Navajo environmentalists have translated the Green Party platform into Navajo and are doing voter registration on their own on the Navajo reservation. There is a lot of dissatisfaction with the two old parties, and I think we're hoping to continue to tap into that and build the Green Party.
terms of the issues that you're going to particularly focus on with the new congressman, what are some of the main issues that you're going to continue to pressure on with the party now?
Well, what we want to see is we want to see true campaign finance reform. We'd like to see an end to negative campaigning. We'd like to see some improvements made in welfare reform. I don't think we're going to be satisfied with what we're getting right now. But unfortunately, what's happened is that because the administration has agreed to a lot of things that are not good for New Mexico, I'm not sure we're going to have the kind of ability to leverage that we would have had in an earlier Congress or with the president not making so many deals up front. I mean, the Medicare cuts to providers much more heavily impact rural health care providers who are about 60% dependent on Medicare compared to urban who are 15 to 30%. So we're going to have to really try and work it as we already do with the other Republicans in the Congress to see that they pay special attention to the rural impacts of a lot of the legislation that they pass.
Carol Miller, do you plan to run again?
Well, I have declared for 98 because we have a lot of momentum here. And the first thing we're going to do is to challenge again a cap. When we look at the money spent per vote, I think that the fact that I could spend $1.73 per vote, the Republican about $12, and the Democrat spent close to $25 per vote, that it shows that people in New Mexico are not swayed by the money. We could become a model for other states and show that you could win without spending these huge amounts of money. So I definitely am continuing to run. We have momentum. We've got an organization now in most of the counties in the district. And I think that there's a real craving for a third party in this country. I think the new party's shown it in the Midwest. I think the Green Party is showing it in a number of states. People do not feel fully represented by just the Democrats and Republicans.
As we wrap up, I wanted to ask you about national Green Party politics, because I understand Ralph Nader, the Green Party presidential candidate, what took his vice presidential candidate to the FEC, and it seems that there are really sort of warring factions within the Green Party right now.
Well, you know, there's two different organizations of the Green Party, and I want to remind people that this is a brand new party that's just really learning how to do a lot of things, and we have one of the best organized Green Parties in New Mexico because we have a county organization and then we have a state organization, and the rest of the Green Party is more membership based, where anyone can join the Green Party and they don't have to work within a structure. And I think that the New Mexico Green Party hopefully will be a model for others, where there is an organized structure and where the party has some say-so on the financing and other things. But people have to remember, we're 5 years old in New Mexico, and we're doing really well. We do have two elected officials in Santa Fe. I think we'll continue to have probably the first Green elected to a state legislature in New Mexico in the next 4 years. So I think that we're learning a lot and that there are differences among people in the ways that people do things. But we're so young.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Carol Miller, the Green Party candidate for Bill Richardson's seat. She lost this week to Republican Bill Redman, and he will occupy that seat, of course, until the 1998 election. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And you are listening to Democracy Now! Again, in just a minute, we'll be joined by Staunton and Alice Lynn. But before we do that, Juan, you have an interesting lunch plan for today.
Oh, Amy, you would ask about this. Yes, I'm supposed to be having lunch today with New York City Police Commissioner Howard Safer and comedian Jackie Mason, of all people, Jackie Mason is a good friend of the commissioner and got very angry because I was writing some columns recently blasting the police department's racial policies and so
discrimination against
discrimination against black and Latino police officers. And so Mason blasted me and told me the commissioner was really an excellent guy. I said I wouldn't know Jackie. The guy has never talked to me. So Mason agreed to to mediate and arrange this lunch with the police commissioner where he's going to prove to me what a wonderful man he is.
How did his letter begin to you, Jackie Mason's?
Well, in typical Jackie Mason style, he said something to the effect, when I criticize someone, I usually try to find out how big they are. If they're the same size as I am, I tell them personally. If they're bigger than me, I write a letter. And if they're much bigger than me, I have a friend write a letter. So since I don't know how big you are, I'm not taking any chances. And I answered him back, Jackie, I'm only 5 feet 10, 175 pounds, and I never carry a knife to work.
Well, we expect to report back on this lunch next week. Raoul Felder is also going to be there, isn't he?
Yes, famed
divorce lawyer.
The society divorce lawyer, yes. He's also a friend of the police commissioners.
Well, I don't know what he would have to do with New York City Police Department hiring and practices, but we'll find out in a few days. Well, as I said, we're now joined by Staughton and Alice Lynn, and they're involved in a very interesting case. In April 1993, a deadly riot broke out at the Southern Ohio Correctional Facility in Lucasville, Ohio, near Cincinnati. 9 prisoners and 1 correctional officer were killed in the Lucasville disturbance. George Skates was a spokesperson for the inmates during part of the uprising. He was 47 years old at the time and in the middle of a long-term sentence for a murder he says he did not commit. He was also a member of the Aryan Brotherhood. At the end of the uprising, 5 inmates, including Skates, were sentenced to death and are presently on death row. 3 of those sentenced to death are Muslims, and 2 are members of the Aryan Brotherhood. We're pleased to be joined today by 2 giants in the American labor and civil rights movement, Alice and Staughton Lynn. They're both lawyers, educators, and authors of numerous books, including Rank and File, Personal Accounts of Working Class Organizers. Staughton Lynn was the director of Freedom School during the 1964 Mississippi Summer Project. And now they've both taken up the case of George Skates and the Lucasville Five. We welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
Well, it's great to be with you. Why don't we start out by you describing just why George Skates is in prison and why you've taken up this issue?
Well, I think that it might be helpful to explain why, as people with a background in civil rights and labor, we now find ourselves confronting this prison issue. The basic fact is that Youngstown, that used to be the second or third steel center of the nation, closed all its steel mills by 1980 and has finally found a new economic development program, which is building prisons. So we have not only new county jails, we have a federal prison, we have a medium security state institution, we have a supermax going up on Youngstown's east side, and also Youngstown's first private prison run by the Corrections Corporation of America. And Alice and I were drawn into the prison field by contemplating what this supermax, very much like the Pelican Bay facility in California, would mean for the human beings who would be locked in cages 23 hours out of every 24. We put on a panel about supermax prisons that was well attended. And as part of that panel, we wanted to find a relative of someone who was in a lockdown situation. And the person who was brought to our attention was a woman named Jackie Bowers, who is the sister of George Skates, one of the Lucasville Five. So that's how we made the connection.
So you made the connection, you learned about George Skates, and learned that he was a member of the White Aryan Brotherhood. Now, the Lucasville Five also include 3 black Muslims.
That's right. And I think that folks who, like myself, have a background in the civil rights movement need to exercise their imaginations here. Let me just provide a couple of facts. One is that white inmates at Lucasville, like George Skates, perceived themselves to be part of a minority. Most of the inmates were black. The warden and assistant warden were and are black. The head of the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction, also black. And so George would describe his action in joining the Aryan Brotherhood not as an expression of white supremacy, but as an effort to establish equality. His statement about the issue of race is, you respect me and I'll respect you. Now, of course, people can say lots of things, but the second fact I would like your hearers to consider is the way that Skates personally and the inmates generally acted, their conduct during this uprising. George was approached three separate times by black inmates who said to him, you need to help us get this thing under control so it will not turn into a race riot. He did that. He went down to the gym. He spoke to the blacks who were assembled on one side of the gym. He said, this is not a time for me to be calling you a nigger or you to be calling me a honky. He then went over to the whites who were sitting in the bleachers on the other side of the gym, put his arm around a black inmate and said, if the guards come in here, they're going to kill us all, regardless of what color we are. He then, along with several others, became one of the spokespersons for this white and black uprising. And one of the extraordinary things to me is that when the highway patrol went into the occupied cell blocks after the 11-day insurrection, after the surrender, they found the walls and bulletin boards plastered with slogans such as black and white together, blacks and whites and blacks, unity, black and white unity, black and white together. These are all separate graffiti to which the highway patrol testified at Skates' trial. So that I think what we have here, and someone has suggested to me that Attica may provide another example, is a group of blacks and whites who formed a coalition, even though they were organized in three groups, the black Muslims, the Aryan Brotherhood, and the black gangster disciples.
Well, Alison Stortland, clearly in the investigations that I've done of prison situations, the Aryan Brotherhood is generally the largest white prison organization throughout the country. In almost all the federal and state prisons, there exist groups of Aryan Brotherhood. And in essence, it's the major white organization, a political white organization in the prison system, just as you would have the Latin Kings or the Crips and Bloods or the Nation of Islam or various other groups among the black Latino inmates. So it doesn't surprise me that any kind of political organization would come out of a group associated with them. But I'm interested specifically in they are all on death row for specific crimes, right? There were several people killed in the prison. And in the material that I read, it seemed to me surprising that he is not actually accused of killing the one prison guard who died, but of actually killing other inmates. Could you tell us a little bit about the specifics of that case?
Yes. George was charged with three murders and three kidnappings. One of the murders with which he was charged was the killing of the guard. But even the prosecution says that there's no evidence linking any inmate to any one of the killings. And the prosecution does not allege that George laid his hand on the guard or on one of the inmates that he was convicted of killing.
I think Alice's essential point is that he was picked out as a leader, the same thing that we so often see in wildcat strikes, other kinds of popular uprisings. And as a matter of fact, The state of Ohio had gotten into the tunnels underneath the occupied cell blocks. They were monitoring the conversations and telephone conversations of the inmates, and their own records, not introduced at Skate's trial, have George on the telephone negotiating at the moment that the guard was killed. So as a labor historian, I compare it to the Haymarket Massacre in 1886.
Staunton, we're going to have to break, but when we come back, you can explain what the Haymarket Massacre was and why certain people were singled out to be killed. We're talking to Staunton and Alice Lynn, lawyers, educators, authors, and now involved with the defense committee, I guess you could say, of George Skates, who was one of the Lucasville Five. They were the people who were involved with the protests of 1993, the riot there in Lucasville. And I also want to thank them for driving an hour, Alice and Staunton Lynn, to the Kent, Ohio radio station, WKSU, to join us today. You're listening to Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. We're joined by Alice and Staunton Lynn in a radio station in Kent, Ohio, as they talk about the death penalty case of George Skates. Again, Alice and Staunton Lynn, author of many books, including Rank and File, Personal Accounts of Working Class Organizers. And Staunton Lynn was the director of the Freedom Schools during the 1964 Mississippi Summer Project. Staunton Lynn, you're talking about the Haymarket Massacre.
Yes, I was. And my point, of course, was that there was a meeting at a downtown public area in Chicago in May 1886 connected with the National Movement for an 8-Hour Day. It was a peaceful meeting. The mayor of Chicago left early because he thought there was no problem. But the police appeared in force at the end of the meeting. Somebody threw a bomb, and a number of people were killed. Now, the connection with the Lucasville disturbance, in my mind, is that it's obvious that the people who were singled out for prosecution and in some cases hanged as a result of the Haymarket event were people who were singled out because they were leaders of the anarchist movement in Chicago at that time. Some of them had not been at the Haymarket meeting. They could not have thrown the bomb. One of them, I believe August Spies, had delivered a speech early in the meeting, but there was no proof connecting him with the bomb. They were nailed by the state because they were spokespersons, because they were leaders. And I think that's true of all five men, not just Skates, all five men now on death row as a result of Lucasville, but that Skates committed the perhaps most unpardonable sin of, as a white person, standing up arm in arm with black people in a life and death situation. White America doesn't like that, and they're trying to kill him for it.
What has been the relationship between the members of the Nation of Islam, who are also on death row, and any attempts to build support for them and the defense of Skates?
Well, since you have to
since they did fight together in the prison, what has happened since then?
Well, they have been proceeding each with his own lawyers. And what we are trying to do, beginning with our relationship with the one man, George Skates, is to identify the relatives and friends of each of the five persons and begin to form a defense committee for all five men. Because as you imply, just as they fought together, the fact that they're threatened with death together is something that we have to keep central. We can't be drawn into a situation where there is an effort to save one person by pointing a finger at others. So we're just at the earliest stages of doing this, but that is our objective.
One of the amazing things to me in reading some of the literature on the case was the disparity, the enormous disparity between the amount of money spent in the prosecution of this case versus the amount of money that was allotted by the state for the defense lawyers. I think something like $2.4 million was spent by the prosecution and $171,000 allotted for the defendants. Could you talk a little bit about that and what impact that has on justice in this case?
Well, those, first of all, are the state of Ohio's own figures. And I think the most dramatic way to talk about what those figures mean is to say that a well-respected Cleveland attorney named Nikki Schwartz helped to negotiate the settlement at the end of the case. And one of the provisions of the settlement was that there would be fair administrative and criminal proceedings. And we have heard Attorney Schwartz say that he feels what has happened since is a travesty of justice. The prosecution attorneys were paid far more than the defense attorneys. Attorney Schwartz says that the prosecutor interfered with the appointment of counsel for the Lucasville defendants because, according to Attorney Schwartz's sworn statement, the prosecutor told him if they have lawyers, they won't confess. The state of Ohio had access to a computerized technology for correlating all of the hundreds of witness statements that were made at the end of the trial, at the end of the uprising. The defense had nothing of the kind. So that you have this disproportion in resources, and then on top of that, you have the practice that the prosecution actually followed, which was going down the row one defendant at a time and asking each one, will you snitch, will you inform on your fellow prisoners, because if you will, you'll get off much more lightly. And Mr. Skates is where he is today because he said, I can't help you, as of course the others of the Lucasville Five did as well.
I have been through a number of witness statements where they say, yes, I participated in such and such a murder, but I didn't want to face the death row. I didn't want to face life imprisonment. And so they agreed to cooperate with the prosecution. When you read the witness statements about George's role, they conflict with one another. There are many instances where the statements they made in court were inconsistent with earlier statements, and they'll give one excuse or another as to why they changed their testimony. But you have, since they have no objective evidence as to who committed any of the murders, they're relying entirely on very unreliable witness testimony.
And Alice, these witnesses, these inmate witnesses, were granted immunity, is that right, to testify against these five, and some of them were involved with the murders?
In some cases, it was immunity. In other cases, it was a plea bargain in the sense of pleading to involuntary manslaughter, maybe getting a sentence of 5 to 25 years In some cases, the sentences ran concurrently with existing sentences so that the person wasn't going to spend any more time in prison than he would have otherwise. In some cases, no charge was brought where the person indicated that he did participate in a murder, but certain other charges were pursued.
I thought it was interesting, just to interrupt, I thought it was interesting that George Skates, who was a spokesperson, was actually displaced as a spokesperson during the Lucasville riot after he departed from his script to deliver a message from one of the hostages, Officer Ratcliffe, to Ratcliffe's family, and also to apologize to the family of the slain officer, Vallandigham.
That is correct, and there is a great deal of evidence to the effect that George protected hostages, protected other prisoners.
Yeah, I mean, this guy just doesn't come across as a murderer on the basis of the transcript or meeting him personally. And Amy and Juan, if I could just add something, of course, one doesn't mean to deny that racism was rife among the Lucasville inmates, as everywhere else in American society. But I think they overcame it to an extraordinary degree. And I think that's now our challenge on the outside. And it's very exciting, very interesting to me that George knows of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Mumia knows of George. I understand from people who visit Mumia as we visit George that Mumia says he respects George as a person of integrity who refused to snitch. And I think that we have here the possibility in Ohio and Pennsylvania and across the country of building a really integrated movement on behalf of the white and black people on death row.
Has George considered dropping his membership in or renouncing the White Aryan Brotherhood, perhaps removing the tattoo that he wears of the SS lightning bolts, the symbol of the White Aryan Brotherhood in prison?
We haven't discussed that particular question with George, but we have... I get it both in people's characterizations of George and in his own characterization of himself that he's essentially a person who acts out of his own sense of what is right and wrong and doesn't is not a person who takes orders or is, you know, like an organization man. He evidently was a person to whom other inmates went in times past, in times of crisis or to resolve problems, because when he would see a problem, he would move into it, try to calm it down, try to settle it, try to get a nonviolent resolution of it. And there are numerous instances of that.
Of course, outside either the left or sections of the extreme right, even the whole issue of defending people who were already convicted felons and then were involved in a prison riot would seem to be a waste of time for a lot of Americans, or a misguided effort at best. But those of us who know about prison life know that all of these hundreds of thousands of people being locked up in the prisons of America continue to have ongoing lives behind bars, political viewpoints, and most of them eventually come out. What have you gleaned or learned in terms of the general situation of prison conditions and the political ferment or development that's going on among the inmates in the country as a result of this case?
Let me just first make the comment that the American Bar Association in February 1997 concluded that the death penalty was being so unfairly and unjustly and unconstitutionally administered. Now, this is the American Bar Association, that they thought there should be a moratorium on implementation of the death penalty. So I agree with you. The fact that a person has been convicted for murder doesn't have very much to do with whether or not he or she really committed that crime.
I wanted to respond to what I thought was another part of your question. the way we got into this, as Staunton mentioned, is that Youngstown has almost, that is, the new supermax prison for the state of Ohio is almost complete in Youngstown. Now, they say that the purpose of a supermax prison is to have a place to put what they call the worst of the worst. That is, people who may have committed violent crimes or engaged in gang activity or even been jailhouse lawyers or have unpopular political views or in some way are regarded as a threat to the institution that they are in. Such people are kept in almost complete isolation from other human beings, and the psychological effects of this are, on the one hand, to increase the level of anger and potential for violence, or to push people into so much depression and inability to function that when they get out, as I understand 97% of prisoners eventually do, they're far less able to become responsible citizens in society and far more likely to either become totally dysfunctional or to express, I mean, what they call, you know, that they just become monsters.
I wanted to change the subject just a bit to ask Staunton, as a longtime labor activist, you the lead attorney against U.S. Steel in the 1970s to stop the closure of the U.S. Steel plant in Youngstown. If the AFL-CIO is taking a stand now around prison issues, one prison labor, also, you know, the closure of plants, for example, the story you describe in Ohio and Youngstown of all these plants closing and now just prison after prison being built, even though, of course, it does provide jobs.
The AFL-CIO has taken a very good position, which is that we have two groups of workers, the folks who are behind bars and the folks on the outside. They should not be set in competition with each other. People on the inside, prisoners, should be given meaningful training so that when they are released, they can make a living and won't go back to prison. But they should not be put to work, as is more and more the trend these days, at work which takes jobs away from union labor on the outside. And the general position is that they should be paid at least minimum wage. I'm talking about prison labor now. And when they do work that is also being done on the outside, they should be paid the prevailing wage for that kind of work.
Well, on that note, we do have to wrap up. And again, I want to thank you very much for traveling over an hour from your home in Youngstown, Ohio, over to Kent, to WKSU, the radio station there, to speak with us. We've been speaking with Alice and Staunton Lynn, longtime labor activists, scholar activists, who are working on the George Skates case. George Skates on death row right now in Ohio. And I should say that talking about death penalty cases, five executions are set to be carried out in Texas over the next week, which is heightening tensions on the state's death row and renewing concerns about new laws limiting the appeals of death row inmates nationwide. And also just last night, after a short delay, Harry Moore was killed in Salem, Oregon. His killing was delayed by 15 minutes because attendants had trouble inserting the tube used to inject a lethal dose of drugs into his arm. If you'd like to get the address of the George Skates Supporters Committee, it is P.O. Box 1591, Marion, Ohio, 43301. That's P.O. Box 1591, Marion, Ohio, 43301. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our assistant producer, and also engineer is Errol Maitland. Want to say thank you very much for listening. We'll be back on Monday. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!